The butterfly effect is a term often used to talk about how a small change in one place can ripple and make a big difference. This hour, stories from you, our listeners, about people who created a butterfly effect of sorts for the better. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're hearing from you, our listeners. You answered our call to honor people who changed your life. We'll hear from a high school student in Des Moines who found mentors while training for a marathon, from a mother in Des Moines whose late son dedicated his relatively short life to the service of others, from a man in Northeast Iowa who wants to thank his English teacher from the 1950s, and from a woman in Ames who traveled to Sweden and met a man who opened the doors to her ancestry. Inspiring personal stories from you, our listeners, after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You've probably heard of the butterfly effect. Well, it's a term often used to talk about how a small change in one place can ripple and make a big difference. This hour, stories from you, our listeners, about people who created a butterfly effect of sorts in your life for the better. We'll hear from listeners who answered the call that Charity Nebbe and I put out to honor the people who made a change in your life for the better. And joining me, first of all, Kate Carter Frederick of Des Moines. Hi, Kate.
Hello, Ben.
You got in touch with us for this, and you go by Kate, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Okay. You got in touch with us, and it was a very moving story that you wanted to tell. First of all, you're a journalist.
Yes, I'm trained as a journalist. I work as an editor and a writer.
Kate, you wanted to talk about your son, Joseph, and in your email to me, you wrote, "He is my hero, someone I look up to and have learned from since before he was born." And we want to mention at the outset that unfortunately, Joseph had a relatively short life. He died in the summer of 2011.
That's right.
I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Tell us about Joseph and what he means to you.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Joseph made such a difference in my life and in others in so many ways. You know, as parents, we try to teach our children, but I think I have learned more from my children than I could ever teach them. Joseph taught me about love and patience and wisdom. I've always encouraged him and his sister, Anna, to be the best people they could be, and Joseph really was. He taught us about being willing to experience new things and to rise to the highest in ourselves. He reveled in exploring and learning and living intensely and passionately. He loved writing, drawing, playing music. He collected things. He loved to watch movies and travel. He was a daredevil from an early age, and he pushed boundaries and really just grabbed life by the horns and demonstrated what it means to be fearless. He really did push us and encourage us to do the same, and his friends too. He was an ardent and steadfast friend, and every one of his friends would tell you, Ben, that Joseph was their best friend.
Now, I understand growing up in Des Moines that Joseph also had a strong sense of service to others. He became an Eagle Scout, right?
Yes, he did, and I think that is such a huge feat for a very young person. For his Eagle Project, he organized and managed a blood drive, and the day that he was supposed to receive his Eagle Scout award, he ended up in the hospital with pneumonia, but he got out of his hospital bed and went to the ceremony and then went back to the hospital. And the next week, he was on his way to Brazil for a student trip. And that's very telling of Joseph. And his sister and I honor him by giving blood, and other people do too. On a regular basis, it's one of the many things that really a legacy to him now.
You mentioned how he really took life by the horns.
Yeah.
and really did it. Did he get that from you or from his father? Did you ever ask yourself, where did this boy get this joy of life from?
I don't know. I've just always thought it was Joseph's spirit. He lived large. He had a huge heart. I think I mentioned to you, too, that when he was in middle school, he started putting together his life list, and this was long before people had bucket lists or even talked about them.
What was on that list?
Oh, my gosh. I have it here. You wouldn't believe some of the things, and some of them I probably couldn't say out loud, but he wanted to skydive, which he did. He wanted to build his own home, build a piece of furniture, master the guitar, which he did. He taught himself how to play the guitar. He wanted to touch a tiger.
didn't do that, did he?
No, I don't think he did that.
Probably a good thing on that one.
He wanted to learn to be a skilled cook, and this is true to form of Joseph, too. Throughout his life, if there was something he wanted to learn more about, he would go to the library, get a pile of books, come home, read them all, and then start in. So he taught himself how to cook, and he learned how to bake and continue some of our family traditions that we have around the holidays with bread. And I just admire him for doing that.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to his service to others, who was a main theme in his life. He studied to become an EMT. He wanted to become a first responder. He wanted to help others in that way as a paramedic.
Yep.
He became a paramedic.
Yes, he was a paramedic. He worked at Johnson County Ambulance Service in Iowa City. He was a paramedic for 5 years.
What stories do you remember him telling you about coming to the aid of others?
Oh, so many. Many of them absolutely heart-wrenching, and they had a profound effect on him over the years. And one of the last calls that he made, he delivered a baby in the back of the ambulance. And that day when he got home from his shift, his feet were off the ground. He was just flying. It was, I think, one of the peak experiences of his life. So often, you know, the first responders and particularly the paramedics are there to help people in difficult times, sad times, crisis, and to help people on their way out of life, which I think is an absolutely profound place for such a young person to have.
But he was okay with that.
Oh, yes. He was so proud of it, and we are so proud of him.
And you should be. You know, when someone passes and they've been in our lives, there are sometimes things that surprise us that we remember about them, perhaps even mundane things, everyday things, about what they said or how they acted. I wonder if you recall any of those things about Joseph.
Oh, my gosh. Every day, day and night, we think about Joseph, and there's no doubt that we continue to learn from him, maybe more now even than we did while we were all here together. You know how, like you say, the mundane aspects of daily life can pull us in and cloud our brains, and there's always 20/20 vision in hindsight, but Joseph had an intensity and a passion for life, and he had a tendency to push other people as well as himself, and he liked to be an expert and an authority and to be right, and many, many people would go around with him, but I think it's all the same people that would tell you today that those were the times that they learned the most and that Joseph gave them some sort of a gift in that process. It's kind of amazing to look at that now and to see that there were many, many gifts along the way. And I, for one, am just astonishingly grateful. My heart is overwhelmed with just so much joy that I feel having been able to share this life with Joseph. He was an amazing person.
He helped others with acute medical problems as a paramedic for those 5 years, but he had medical problems himself, chronic sleep problems, I understand, that somehow contributed to his early death.
Yes, Joseph had sleep apnea, and he died in his sleep.
At the age of 25.
Yes, he was only 25. He had just taken a year off to work full-time and to take a breather from working and going to school at the University of Iowa, and it was just so hard on him to work and study at the same time. His work was so intense, and their work schedule is literally, it's killer. It's, you know, they work 18, 24, 36-hour shifts, and they need to be on their toes and prepared to handle anything that happens. And Joseph did have chronic sleep deprivation, and the sleep apnea started to get worse once he became a paramedic, and we were in the process of getting some medical treatment for him, but I don't know if it was just his time to leave this life or what, but he did.
You have, Kate Carter-Frederick, you have experienced one of the worst things imaginable a parent can live through, the death of your own child. How have you, it's a year and a half since his death, how have you managed to find something in there that you can live with without knowing the answer to the question you just raised, but still finding something positive in there, which you surely have?
Oh, it's hard to answer, Ben, without being emotional, because it is such a heart-shattering loss. My heart is still shattered, but I have started to pick up pieces and with my daughter Anna to carry on and in our lives and to press on. And I really think the one thing that helps me the most to do that is to believe that Joseph is with us in spirit. And other than that, I take a lot of deep breaths. I do yoga. I go for long walks. We try to laugh, and we cling to happy memories. We try to find new ways to carry on. I think we're still discovering those. There were a lot of weeks and months when I felt that I couldn't even breathe. I couldn't sleep. It's just so shattering.
Grief can be grief, mourning the life of someone close to you, can be such an intensely private thing. You reached out to us to tell us about Joseph, and we're so glad you did. Some might be asking, why share this with all of Iowa public radio listeners?
Well, I had my radio on early one morning, Ben, as I often do, and I heard your voice asking people to share their stories about someone who had made a difference in their lives, and I just felt so completely compelled to let you know about Joseph, because he made such a huge difference in my life and the life of everyone in our family and his friends and in the lives of really thousands of people who he touched as a paramedic. You know, when you throw a stone into the water and the circles go out from where that stone drops into the water, it's like that. I think everyone has that capability to make a difference in life and in the world. And I guess that's something also that we do as parents. We try to impress upon our children that we're not just here to take up space. We're here to leave the world a better place and to make a difference in the lives of other people. And Joseph really lived that. He had astonishing integrity, and he was just a great model.
Kate, thank you so much, and our deepest sympathies for you and your family here from Iowa Public Radio. We're very sorry for your loss. Thank you for sharing your thoughts about this tremendous son of yours, Joseph.
Oh, thank you, Ben. I'm really, really grateful for this opportunity to visit with you about Joseph. Thank you so much.
Joining me now, Ray Edwards. Hi, welcome to River to River.
Hi, Ben. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. You are a junior at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines, I understand, sir.
I am.
You want to tell us about something that people in the Des Moines area know of. You certainly love it. It's called See Us Run Des Moines. What is that?
Well, See Us Run Des Moines, basically, it takes kids and it trains them for a marathon. We train for about 7 or 8 months, and then we run the marathon, the Des Moines Marathon, in October.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start doing that?
Well, the group started back in April 15th, and we ran the marathon in October 21st.
How did you do?
I finished in 4 hours, 53 minutes, and 22 seconds.
That's nice, and that's, what, 26 miles?
Yep, 26.2.
Did you hit the much-talked-about wall around 18 miles?
No, I think I hit mine around mile 20.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like I got like really tired and my body was just like aching really badly. So the last 6.2 miles was kind of a tough
right.
last stretch.
Well, congratulations on that. I wonder, how do your parents feel about your newfound love of running and this club?
Well, my mom, she tells me, well, when I first started, she was like, I don't think you're going to be able to do it. And so she was pretty doubtful of me. But after I did it, she was just full of emotion. She was proud of me. And as I crossed the finish line, she was just held on to me and cried.
Really? How nice. Now, before joining See Us Run Des Moines, this group to train you for their marathon in April, were you a runner? I imagine so, huh?
No, I was not. I had not done anything sports-wise at all. This is the first thing I've ever done.
So what drew you to the group?
Well, I wanted to do track. I wanted to get into track, but I was lazy, and I didn't get my papers filled out, and I didn't get them turned in. And then I was walking in the hall, and one of my teachers stopped me and was like, hey, would you like to run a marathon? And I was like, yeah. So I signed up, and I did it.
Uh-huh. That seems to me and so many of the listeners, I'm sure, is something so insurmountable, especially for someone who's not a runner. When you turned up at that first group meeting or that first training exercise, did it click or did it take a while for you to figure out, I can do this?
It took a while for me to figure out that I could do this. When we got up into like our really long runs, like the 10 miles and 13 miles, that's when it really clicked that like, hey, I'm doing this. This is happening and I can do this.
Mm. Did you noticed yourself changing mentally then?
Yes, yes. One of the things that they taught us to tell ourselves was that we can do this. This is nothing. It's just another day, and we're going to get it done.
Mm. So when we reach out for things, people who have changed lives, what you're talking about is a group of people who changed your life.
Yes, yep. I think the group changed everybody's lives for the better.
Hmm. There's someone in this group named Paxton as well, isn't there?
Yes, Paxton. He was my mentor for the last half. When I first started, I had a mentor named Kenny, and he was put with me, and then I got better and I got faster, so I got put with Paxton. And Paxton's a work of art.
How do you mean that?
Like, a month before we ran our marathon, he flew over to Germany to do a marathon over there.
Okay.
And then after we ran our marathon, a few days before Thanksgiving, he did another marathon. So
you're running your first marathon, the Des Moines Marathon, this past October. You hit the wall at around mile 20. I imagine something that Paxton said came to mind to spur you on.
Yeah, Paxton was just like, he was there for me. He was just really supportive. He was like, take it slow. We can do this. We're going to finish before your time that you want to finish. My scheduled time to finish was 4:30, but after I hit the wall, I was like, I want to finish before 5 hours. So he paced me. He kept me in check, and we finished before 5 hours.
Did he run along with you?
He did the whole time.
And for him, maybe as a veteran, a stroll in the park, perhaps.
Yes. Yeah.
This is an interesting story. Never having been a runner, you join a group, become a marathon runner in the course of a few months.
Yep.
How has this changed you as a person, Ray?
Well, I think that, I'm a lot more friendlier. My grades are better. I'm not going out and partying. I'm just a good kid.
You weren't a good kid before?
I was, but, just running and having this running define me, it's who I am now. It's such a big part of my life, and, I love it, and it just keeps me in check.
Wow. Have you told the group's members at CS Run Des Moines what you're telling me today?
Yeah, we have. I have. We had a banquet a few months ago after we ran the marathon, and all the runners or all the students had a chance to talk to all the mentors and tell them how happy we are and how grateful we are for them.
And how did they react?
Well, when I spoke, I guess I made some of the students cry and some of the mentors cry as well, so I guess they really hit home.
Ray Edwards, you're what, 17?
I am, yep.
As a junior at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines, I wonder if you can leave us with a message for everyone here, whether you're a runner or not, that you take from this experience that you could pass on to pretty much anyone.
Well, all I have to say is that with anything that you're in, that the group taught us that if you have the right mindset and you tell yourself that you can do something, and you just tell yourself repeatedly that you can do it, you'll end up doing it. But you just got to have the right mindset.
Hmm. Ray Edwards, thanks for getting in touch with us and telling us your story about CS Run Des Moines and many years of happy running to you.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, we'll hear from a man in Northeast Iowa who wants to thank his English teacher from the 1950s for the tremendous influence she had on his life. We'll also hear from a woman in Ames who traveled to Sweden and met a man who opened the doors to her ancestry. That's after a short break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Most of us have someone we can point to who has done or said something which changed our life. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this is River to River. Today on our program, hearing from listeners who answered our call, a call to honor people in their lives, family members, these could be teachers, mentors, friends, someone who gave that pivotal push in the right direction, who changed a life. We're looking at inspiring personal stories today, hearing them from you, our listeners. Joining me now, Bill Sheridan of Urbandale, Iowa. Thank you for being with us, Bill.
Well, it's an honor. I've been a great fan of River to River for many years, so it's just great fun to be on it.
Well, good. Well, you've got a nice story to tell about someone who touched your life, and this is encapsulated. You tell this story in a short chapter on a self-published book that you've come out with, Depot Street Memories, the Lawler Stories, and the title of the chapter in which you address this special person is called Mrs. Mack. So you're talking about someone you referred to in class as Mrs. Mack, and in your essay, I just want to quote here before you tell us the story, that you said that she's a person who helps draw out the best that you can be and helps you realize that you have a responsibility to share your gifts and talents with others. Mrs. McGreevy is her real name. What's her full name, Bill?
It's Justine McGreevy. And the first sentence of that little chapter reads like this: everyone needs a Justine McGreevy in his or her life, a person who helps draw out the best you can be and helps you realize that you have a responsibility to share your gifts and talents with others, a mentor, an encourager, a conscious, a motivator, a friend. That really sums up Mrs. Mack for me. I'll soon be 69 years old. I had her as an English teacher for 4 years back in the last 2 years of the 50s and the first 2 years of the 60s. And to this day, things that she said and did have impacted my life and lives of other people that I know.
Mm. Mrs. McGreevy taught English when you were a younger man at Lawler High School. This is in the northwest part of the state?
In northeast Iowa.
Northeast, I'm sorry.
Up near Decorah. And the school is now Turkey Valley. The first 2 years I went there, it was Lawler High School. And then we were one of the first consolidated high schools in Iowa, and it's now Turkey Valley High School. It has been for over 50 years.
Her husband was the principal of that high school, and her youngest son, Tom, was a classmate of yours. Take me back to who you were before you met Mrs. McGreevy, because we're talking about change here, right? You write in your essay that you were a person who, like many young people, were filled with insecurity and doubt.
Yeah, I really was. I think one of the things that she helped me most from a very personal basis, when I was 7 years old, my father took his own life, and I think that I just was sort of shy and a little bit of kind of afraid of life. I didn't realize that at the time, and that it was a wonderful little community in which to grow up. But when I got to her class the first time, it's the first time I ever wrote about what had happened in my life, and I felt it was going to be a safe place to do it, and it was absolutely right. She not only encouraged me and told me what a nice job I did writing, but then she encouraged me to do more and congratulated me on writing about something so personal, mm-hmm. and it just gave me an avenue that I did not have before.
So you in her class, maybe for the first time, wrote about your father's suicide when you were just 7 years old. Later on, is this the first time that you'd addressed it in writing?
Right. I was probably, about 15, 16 years old when mm-hmm. I was a freshman in school. It's the first time I did that. And then I found out I could write about other things, and I could write about things that sometimes it was hard for me to express verbally. But then she, not just with me, but with many, many students, taught us, don't be afraid to make a mistake. Go ahead and challenge yourself. And that's what I did. And I started through the years. I can remember, Ben, many times. I remember years and years later when I was teaching out at Fort Dodge St. Edmund. I was an English teacher, and that's kind of a story in itself, but I wanted to be a radio announcer, but I was afraid to do it. And I knew that I might be able to get a part-time job down at a local station. And I remembered her encouragement, saying, you know, don't be afraid to do something. Go ahead and do it and just see what happens. And
I've heard a phrase that sounds just like this: feel the fear and do it anyway.
Oh, I love that. I had not heard that before, but I just love it. And that would be Mrs. Mack. And in this little book that interested me was, I think I probably had 42 or 3 page chapters. None brought as much reaction, Ben, as this, the chapter about Mrs. McGreevy, because I heard from people younger than me by 10 years and older than me by I don't know how many years, all said Mrs. McGreevy was my favorite teacher.
Okay, well, tell us. There'll be teachers listening. There's people thinking back on their teachers as they listen to this. You were, by your own account, insecure, doubtful at this age, really unhinged, coping with your father's suicide many years earlier, yet you felt safe in Mrs. Mack,
yeah.
Mrs. Mack's class, Mrs. McGreevy's class. Can you describe what she did that made you feel safe? It was okay to express really uncomfortable feelings.
Well, I think probably the biggest thing that she did for me was telling me both directly and indirectly that it was all right. And I think teachers very often have no idea the impact that they can have on people's lives. Along those lines, in my note to you, I mentioned that at one time she asked me what I was going to do when I got out of high school, and I said, well, I'd like to be a teacher. I said, I can't afford to go to college, but if I ever can, I'd love to be an English teacher. Oh, she said, Bill, don't do that. She said, you spend all your time correcting papers, and there's no money in it. But her action spoke so loudly that I didn't hear what she said.
Uh-huh.
And I could just envision myself doing what she did, influencing young minds. And eventually, when I finally was able to buy, borrow, beg, and steal and go to college, I did become an English teacher. And anytime I've gotten I taught for 10 years, and sometimes I'll hear from students saying I impacted their life, and I just tell them about Mrs. McGreevy because I'm trying to pass it forward, very frankly.
You, I believe you became an English teacher in 1968 in your essay at St. Edmund High School in Fort Dodge.
Right. Taught there for 10 years. Absolutely loved it. I think the thing that I learned from Mrs. Mack was to treat my students with respect. I didn't try to be their friends. That wasn't my job. My job was to treat them with the most respect I could, and to be an encourager, to be a motivator, just all the things that she did for me.
Have you, Bill, been able to, in person, or perhaps drop her a note to thank her for this impact on your life?
Oh, I am so glad you said that. The one thing I am so grateful for, she passed away probably 10, 15 years ago, but I never passed up an opportunity, Ben. Once a year or so, I would drop her a note, or if we'd get back up to Lawler when we were living in Fort Dodge or even Des Moines, where we live in Des Moines area where I live now. But I would make sure that when I could, I would stop in and just say hello to her or send her a postcard, or just I'd let her know how much I cared for her and how much I appreciated her. And that's one thing I would ask your listeners to consider. If there's somebody, and I don't care who it is, a parent, a teacher, a friend, a neighbor, I don't care who it is, if they have someone who's had a positive influence on his or her life, please let them know it. Don't regret it and say, I wish I would have done that.
Right. And in tribute to Josine Martin McGreevy, known as Mrs. Mack, as you said, in that high school class, you had that time, the 10 years, I think you said, as an English teacher. But also, teachers, it's not exclusive to teachers. Anybody can be a role model, a mentor. Have you tried to be that person for others since meeting her?
I absolutely have. I hope I've succeeded in various ways, not just in my teaching days, but when I was in business. I was a sales manager at a insurance agency, and then I worked for two large insurance companies as a trainer and working with young people in their 20s to 40s, and did everything I could to help each young man or woman become the best that they can be. And I think that's a responsibility that we all have. And I think the most important thing you can do, in my opinion, is to give them respect, give them encouragement. Don't be afraid if they're doing something that isn't correct in whatever their profession or business is. Tell them that, but do it in a loving and caring way.
All great messages from you, Bill Sheridan, especially during our holiday time when we have a little bit of a break, hopefully, from the get-go, the hectic part of our lives otherwise, so we can reflect a little bit. Bill Sheridan, thank you for giving us a story to reflect on and some motivation to get in touch with those who've changed our lives. Bill Sheridan of Urbandale, Iowa, thank you.
Yeah. Ben, it's been an honor to be on your program. Thank you very much.
Joining me now is Sandy Ward. She's a resident of Ames in our Ames studio. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Ben.
You got in touch with us. We are so grateful that you did, because you've got a wonderful story to finish up our show today. It involves a dream that you had for many years to visit Sweden. Tell us about it.
Well, Ben, both sides of my family come from Sweden, which is rather unusual this day and age that 100% is Swedish. And so I had always wanted to go back and explore Sweden to see where my relatives had come from. And I did have a chance last summer in June to go with my husband and his my son and his wife for a week in Sweden.
Mm-hmm. And I understand you brought some names of your Swedish ancestry along to, what, you had a wild idea? Well, maybe I'll find something out.
Yes, I had the names of my great-grandparents who had homesteaded land in Boone County in 1849. They had immigrated along with their six children. But I had their names and their son's name, Daniel Peterson, that I really was curious about. I knew the church where they came from in Sweden, but that was about it. They were founding settlers of Dayton Township back then. And my brother had been farming the land that they homesteaded and lived in the home that they had built. So I was very curious about what would happen if I found that church.
Mm. And you did. So when you were in Sweden, that's the first place you sought out, was that church?
Actually, I had gone to my father's relatives, and there I had more information as far as my grandmother's birthplace and things about that village, but it was in a totally different district. We went to this other church where the Boone people came from, Boone County people, later on in the trip.
The place you went to is called Ulrika?
Ulrika.
Mm. And this is in a portion of Sweden, Östergötland.
Yes, it sounds like Östergötland, but according to my Swedish friend here, that is not how we say it. It's supposed to be Östergötland, something like that.
Okay. So you found this church in this area, in this town, and then you ran into a person who changed everything. Who was that?
His name was Chris Anderson, and we had just gotten to the town and found the church. And surprisingly, it was opened in the middle of the week. And we had just walked in, and a man came to us and said, "May I help you?" in English, about a 50-year-old man. He explained that he was the caretaker of the church and that he loved genealogy. So I showed him the three names that I had, and he said, "Oh, can you wait here? I go home and get my book." So in 5 minutes, he came back with this book about an inch and a half thick, written by the guru of Swedish genealogy, Bo Lundvald. And he had written a book, this genealogist, about this particular church since its beginning in 1737.
What's the name of the church?
It's just the church in Ulrika.
Okay.
There's no church.
So he brought back this book and he found the names you had brought?
As I was standing there, he started cross-referencing the names I had, and he stopped and he paused and he looked up at this beautiful brass chandelier hanging above me, and he said, "Do you know that your grandparents 8 generations ago donated this brass chandelier, and their names are even engraved on this chandelier?"
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, I started, like, shaking. I was so
amazed.
Oh, I
bet. Did you then get up to the chandelier to have a look at it?
Oh, yes.
And the engraved names?
Yes, and we got pictures, and it was just an amazing thing. And then Chris went on to tell me that after this couple, they were founders of this church in 1737, and at the opening celebration where the bishop and all the big people, important people came to celebrate, They had the entire church out to their home after the service for a meal. And he said that was an amazing thing to do back then.
And back then, we're talking the 1700s.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so he helped you also in other ways to discover this chandelier. What is the story behind why the chandelier was given to the church?
You know, he didn't know that, but he told me some wonderful stories about this couple, because Ben, in Sweden at that time, you were assigned your Lutheran church. It was a state Lutheran church. And these farmers in this little town had to go to a church that was way far away to do their baptism, their burials, their marriage. It was the important thing that they had to do. So, and the terrain in Sweden in that part is like northern Minnesota. So it was no small feat to get their babies to be baptized or christened, and to get the coffins to the grave or to the church to have the burial. So he said that these men, this and Hemming, this man who gave the chandelier, was a part of a group of people who said, we need to have a church closer. And they petitioned the bishop, and initially was refused. The bishop said, you can't afford this church in your area, but these stubborn Swedes were persistent, I'm told, and they did convince the bishop that they could support a church. And so Chris, as he was telling me these stories, he said, you know, you come from people, Sandy, who not only wanted to better themselves, but they wanted to better their community. And that just brought tears to my eyes, because how wonderful that a man, a stranger, could tell me such good information about my ancestors.
Does that change your identity or a little different sense of yourself, your family?
Oh, absolutely. I went home and I told my mom, you cannot believe what I found out. And of course, she kind of said, well, it wasn't anything bad, was it? It just deepens. I mean, I've always had a fairly good sense of self and who I am. But finding this information out was just a whole new dimension in just who I am as a person and how I see what my ancestors way back then were doing for the community. I've been able to see that in my mom and her sisters and other family members, and it just is so amazing that, as Chris Witz said often through the week, you know, it must be in the genes, Sandy. Yeah. So it was really touching. And Chris was so amazing in and of himself, because he would give me family trees of that one particular family that I brought over, the names of. But then he also started exploring others, actually my mother's, all of her grandparents. And it turns out that they all came from this same church, and nobody knew that. And Chris even found 8 relatives of his that we share. So we started.
You're related to Chris.
Yes. Oh. We started calling each other cousin. So.
And I understand he took you to some other areas that had meaning for your family and ancestry.
Yes, he took me to the farm where that couple who donated the chandelier had lived and probably brought the people of the church there. He just went over and above. He also showed me outside the church, the cemeteries are there. So he showed me the places where my ancestor had been buried also.
And you still have contact with Chris Anderson to this day?
I love emails. I love the internet. Yes, I do.
I wonder if this makes you think, you know, the gift of this chandelier to the church, about actions that you might take that would be remembered and thought of so well 7 or 9 generations in the future as this has done.
It has made me very aware of how I am called to share what I've been given. And fortunately, my husband shares that belief too. And we are so inspired, so inspired. We just look at each other and say, remember the chandelier. It is so much better to give than to receive. And, you know, we come from a spiritual aspect in that we know that we could never outgive God. And we have been so blessed. And I have been so blessed by meeting Chris. And finding out these wonderful, wonderful stories about my relatives.
These would be Lutherans. Your family heritage would be Lutheran, correct?
Lutherans, yes.
there's the way
Lutherans,
you
say it. Lutherans, yeah, sure.
Could you give us a nice Merry Christmas in Swedish?
God jul.
God jul.
God jul.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing that with us, Sandy. Happy holidays to you and your family.
Thank you, and you too, Ben.
And that brings us to the end of this program. We want to thank you once again for all the many responses to the invitation that Charity Nebbe and I sent out to you, our listeners, to share these stories of one life changing another. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Also help and aims from Alyssa Weiss, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Coming up the first part of next week, we'll have some special holiday programming for you. Then we'll be back midweek with more of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Happy holidays, and thanks for joining us.